Hi, I'm Kevin Griffin. And if you're watching this and you don't know that, well, now you do. It is Friday, July 21st, 2023. And for the astrologers in the crowd, that means that we're moving from Cancer into Leo, which is probably why it's so hot. Okay, that's really not even f a funny joke. This is something I mentioned to Paola last night. Is it a if when you make a joke, if it's not funny, is it still a joke? Or it's a koan, It was a joke, but it wasn't funny. Okay. I'm hearing sounds from someone. I'm going to use the powers that I have to mute all. So we are going to meditate for about 30 minutes. And then by then I will have pulled myself together and I will, bring great wisdom and insight to us all, God willing. All right, that was a joke because, I don't believe in God. So we're going to have to edit this, Angela, because I said I don't believe in God and that could upset somebody. I don't want people to get upset. And it's not really true. I actually believe in God. It's just I don't believe in their God. All right, meditating. So settling into a posture that's supportive of clarity and calm. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze so that you are first, turning your attention away from the visual world. And this will tend to bring forward in your awareness other elements of experience, be they sound or sensation or feelings. So I think of this as just turning inward. And seeing how you feel right now. And letting the breath act as a kind of calming agent. Opening and releasing with the breath. And letting the body soften, sense of releasing any tension, softening the belly, relaxing the jaw, letting the shoulders drop if they're hunched at all. It's as though you're feeling yourself being drawn back to the earth. Noticing any sounds in your environment. Sound of my voice. Any prominent sensations, any mood or emotional energies that are calling for attention, just tuning in there as well. And there's this general sense of non-resistance, of receptivity. Before we even try to direct the attention, starting with this sense of openness and acceptance, so that we're not meditating with the idea of controlling the experience or the outcome. Instead, we bring the quality of observing or investigating whatever is arising. And we use the breath as a focal point as a way of naturally, smoothly calming the body, calming the mind. And even in this process, it's still natural for thoughts to arise, to capture our attention. Oh, anytime you notice thinking happening and dominating the mind, just first, really being aware of that activity, and then coming back to the breath. One great Buddhist teacher calls the breath the body conditioner. And he suggests we use the breath to condition the body's state. Use the breath to calm the body. And find the healing power of breathing consciously. Rather than trying to stop thoughts, try to not be disturbed by our thoughts. Let them come, let them go. Welcome again. I thought I would draw on a text that's about being attached to people, because I had an experience today of being overly invested in somebody else's life. And so this just occurs to me, a sutta that I wrote a chapter about this in Living Kindness. And it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it is number 87, for those who want to sing along. And so I'll read some segments of this. And since some of you are new and also maybe just aren't that familiar, I'll give you a little bit of the background on just the suttas themselves. So this is one of the several large collections of teachings, and this is the one called the Middle Length Discourses, Majjhima Nikaya in Pali. And so they're collected just because they aren't really long and they aren't really short. They're middle length. The way the suttas are collected is not kind of related to any really themes generally. Sometimes there's thematic sections, but this collection is just apparently put together because they're not too long and not too short. And then it starts, as do most of the suttas, with the phrase, "Thus have I heard." And this is a famous phrase in Buddhist history and the Buddhist tradition, which is supposed to be the voice of Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant for the last 25 years of his life, according to what we understand about that time. And Ananda heard, you know, everything that the Buddha taught over those 25 years, and he's said to have had the gift of perfect recall, so he would recite. He recited all these things after the Buddha's death, and then people memorized them. And that's where the tradition of chanting comes from in Buddhism. I think in the West, we sometimes get the idea that chanting is about, like, sort of getting into some ecstatic state or getting really concentrated, just repeating a lot, like a phrase over and over. But originally the purpose of chanting was so that everybody together would recite the teaching. And that way everybody would know the teaching, but it would also keep the teaching from varying. Because if somebody said the wrong word, people would look at him and go, "No, you got that wrong," because they'd all be saying it together, right? So that's where the chanting comes from. So that's followed, "Thus have I heard," is followed by, "On one occasion, the Blessed One," which is how the Buddha is referred to often in the text. "The Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetis Grove and Natapindika's Park." And this is a famous monastery. It's still on the the pilgrimage tours of India, the Buddhist places. I mean, there's nothing much there, apparently. I think there's just a couple of piles of stone and sort of, but it was this land that Anathapindika was this wealthy businessman who was a devoted follower of the Buddha, and he wanted to give the Buddha a place to set up a monastery. So he looked around and he found this grove in this town, Savatthi, which was a major city, I believe, in Kosala, or either Kosala or, yeah, I think Kosala. So which is like a small principality. And it turned out that this land, this grove, was owned by a prince named Jetta. And so Anathapindika approached Jetta and said, "I'd like to buy your grove and give it to the Buddha." And Jetta was like, "It's not for sale." And Anathapindika, who was wealthy, said, "How about if I cover the grove with golden coins?" And Jetta's like, "Oh, that's kind of too good a deal to turn down." And he thinks that it's like a bluff. And he's like, "Okay." And Anathapindika's like, "Okay, here we go." And Jetta's like, wait, what, really? Okay, what? Why do you want this? You're giving it to who? The Buddha? Wow, that guy must be really special. Well, if he's that great, I want to keep a little bit because I want to give part of it myself." So he gave like the entranceway, I believe is how it's, and his name then continues to be associated with it. So it's Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. This is the place. So Jetta walked away wealthy. "Now, on that occasion, a certain householder's dear and beloved only son had died. After his son's death, he had no more desire to work or to eat. He kept going to the charnel ground and crying, 'My only son, where are you? My only son, where are you?' Then that householder went to the Blessed One and, after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One said to him, 'Householder, your faculties are not those of one in control of his own mind. Your faculties are deranged.' 'How could my faculties not be deranged, venerable sir? For my dear and beloved only son has died. Since he died, I have no more desire to work and eat. I keep going to the charnel ground and crying, my son, my only son, where are you? My only son, where are you?'" So this is a very, to me, a very striking exchange. Because, you know, this poor guy, this only son has died. He comes to the Buddha for some consolation and maybe for him to, like, you know, perform a miracle and bring his son back. And all the Buddha has to say is, "Your faculties are deranged. You know, you've lost control of your mind." So, well, I'll read a little bit more and then I'll say a little bit more about it. So after the, you know, the householder thinks, you know, it's reasonable that I'm going crazy. And the Buddha says, so it is. "Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." And the householder replies, "Venerable sir, who would ever think that sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear? Venerable sir, happiness and joy are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." Then, displeased with the Buddha's words, disapproving of them, the householder rose from his seat and left. So, you know, that this statement by the Buddha, I mean, both these statements are, I think, very challenging. But this idea that suffering is born from those who are dear, you know, is kind of hard to take. But there is an irrefutable logic to it, you know, that when those we love, when something harmful befalls them, we suffer, you know, we grieve. If we lose someone, if a beloved person dies, we're heartbroken. So it brings to forth the question then, what does the Buddha expect of us? Does he think we shouldn't care about people, that we shouldn't form attachments? That no one should be dear to us. So I will respond to that question. But I'll give you a little bit more of the sutta. So after, so now it says, now on that occasion, some gamblers were playing with dice not far from the Blessed One. And you should know that gamblers are not, you know, looked on in a positive light in Buddhism. Then the householder went to those gamblers and said, "Just now, sirs, I went to the recluse Gotama, and after paying homage, I sat down to one side," and he tells the whole story, repeats the whole conversation. "And I said to him, 'Happiness and joy come from those who are dear.'" And the gamblers say, "So it is, householder, so it is. Happiness and joy are born from those who are dear." Then the householder left thinking, "I agree with the gamblers." Now we know that if you agree with the gamblers and disagree with the Buddha, you are off track, right? You are like, you're listening to the wrong people here. This is not where you get your guidance. It's like lower companions, as we would say in the recovery world. Eventually, this story reached the king's palace. Then King Pasenadi of Kosala told Queen Malika, "This is what has been said by the recluse Gotama. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. If that has been said by the Blessed One, sire, then it is so." Well, so Malika is a devoted follower of the Buddha. King Pasenadi, you know, is a follower, but not devoted. So he says, "No matter what the recluse Gotama says, Malika applauds it. If that has been said by the Blessed One, sire, then it is so. Just as a pupil applauds whatever his teacher says to him, so it is, teacher, so it is. Malika, no matter what the recluse says, you applaud it. If that has been said by the Blessed One, then it be so. Be off, Malika, away with you." These two show up in a lot of the suttas, King Pasenadi and Queen Malika. Then Queen Malika addressed the Brahmin Nalajanga, and he said, you know, asked him, this Brahmin, to go and ask the Buddha if this is what he said. And so he does, and the Buddha, yeah, says, "Yeah, that's what I said." He comes back and tells Malika this, and they come to understand. Wow, this really gets dark here. I had forgotten how dark this sutta is, but you know, finally King Pasenadi kind of comes to understand what's being said, because Queen Malika says, "Well, what if your daughter, you know, died? What if something happened to your daughter?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, of course I would suffer." So it sets up this challenge for us that I thought was interesting to address, which is why I wrote about it. And it's what I said before. Does this imply that we should have no connections with people? And we can see, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, you know, the most devoted followers of the Buddha, the monks and nuns, they leave their homes. They don't have any romantic entanglements. They don't, you know, if they're, sometimes they're married and they, you know, they leave their marriage, you know, but basically they're not in any kind of intimate relationships, you know, that are necessarily emotionally entangling. So we could say, well, that's, yeah, this is this model the Buddha sets up. But then if you look more closely, if you've ever met a monk or been to a monastery, you realize, well, these people are very close together. You know, they hold them each other dear, you know, their relationship with them. There's certainly some feeling of attachment. And yeah, I imagine there's like some advanced state of enlightenment where, like, you know, nothing bothers you, but what I think the Buddha is saying is not saying you shouldn't have feelings or any sorrow if someone dies, but rather that, as he says, that your faculties do not become deranged, you know, that you don't become, you don't lose your mind, you don't kind of get lost in your life. Certainly grief is a natural thing, and that if you understand that having connections with people means that there will be some pain, then you can hold that with wisdom. Because I think one of the, for me, really important ideas in Buddhist teachings is that if we aren't confused, if we understand reality, even if it's difficult, it's not overwhelming. It's when we're confused and we don't understand, why is this happening? You know, why has my child died? Or what, you know, why are these bad things happening? Then one can get deranged. You know, one can really go off the rails when you're just confused. But when you when you understand everything is impermanent, it's bound to end, you know, that then you don't have to get caught in the same way. It may be painful, but it's not really dukkha in the sense that the Buddha talks about, which is like a kind of pain that's lost in confusion. So, I mean, I take this, even though it's a difficult teaching, I take it somewhat as comforting. And this is, you know, I mean, in a way, this is my personality, I admit, you know. You know, one of my friends who was at the class last night wanted to like bring up like the positive side of mindfulness, you know, which is great, you know. And it's like, it's not all about suffering. And of course, that's true. But I know in my life, I've struggled a lot emotionally. And what's really helped me in the last couple decades as I've gotten more deeply into the Dharma is this sense of seeing the way things are and not turning it into a story or a, you know, this is who I am or this shouldn't be happening or what's wrong, you know, why is this happening, but much more holding it with wisdom, you know, seeing, as I say, everything is impermanent and that there is inevitable pain in life, and that's okay, because there's also inevitable joy in life. And the less that I get caught up in confusion and struggle with pain, the less hold it gets on me. It tends to pass much more quickly when I just see, oh, well, that's uncomfortable, that's unpleasant, that's sad. You know, it's and this came up for me today out of a very strange way, you know, which is that this young man that I had met last year, who's trying to create a career as a professional golfer. We happened to play a round of golf together, and I told him about mindfulness. And I started helping him to learn to practice mindfulness and to try to apply it when he plays. And this, you know, this week he had some big successes, and then he had, you know, a really bad day today. And I realized, wow, I'm really caught up in like this young man's success. He's not related to me. I have no obligation to him. But I got attached, you know, I got kind of caught up in, he became dear to me. and so I was reflecting, well, it's interesting, like, that I feel this strongly about this. You know, and it's that kind of thing, you know, for many of you have this experience of being an older person and helping a younger person. And really, it's really hard to watch young people struggle, right? If you have kids, especially, and, you know, you're trying to help them. It's like, oh, did I let them down? Or not even about me, really, but like, oh, I don't want them to struggle. And so, you know, it's what made me think of this sutta, because it's really, this is, you know, what it's about. And it comes back to the essential thing that it comes back to for me is refuge in the Dharma, that I take refuge in the Dharma. That is to say, at the end of the day, what's true is true, and there is a larger truth and a more important truth than the ups and downs, the successes and failures of us or others, or, you know, the struggles or the joys. This is all just part of the, you know, the play of life. And we breathe with it, and we sit with it, and we let it go, and it passes. But you know, I guess bringing this back to recovery, you know, it's what brings us into recovery is when we finally see the truth of our addiction. And so in the same way that seeing the truth that attachment causes suffering, if I see that addiction causes suffering, that gives me an opportunity to change and to experience it differently. So I still say I'm an alcoholic and an addict, but it's not acting on me in the same way because I've changed my relationship to it. And we can do the same thing with the places that where we cling, that we change our relationship to it. We're not so overwhelmed by it. We see it, we feel it, it's unpleasant. I mean, you may still have cravings, right? You know, we still say we're powerless, you know, but there's a wisdom that's like coming out of denial is the other way of saying that is having insight, you know, having insight into our own clinging, into our own addictive behavior, addictive tendencies. So, yeah, I think that's, I'll just leave it at that. And I hope that's makes some sense, some value. Just open it up and see if anybody wanted to share anything. I haven't left everyone in a bleak mood. Yes. But Deb, cheer us up, Debbie.
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I'm going to cheer people up. But so, you know, I just, you know, seeing or reading this and hearing it, you know, the Buddha offers this teaching, but he doesn't go beyond it and give, quote unquote, the conclusion, right?
Right. That's right.
So it's like, had, you know, had Malika and, you know,
Pasanati,
yeah. Had they had previous teachings, and, you know, were they able to kind of conclude, oh, this, yes, yeah, so we just let go attachment? Or might this have been followed up with, you know, with the teaching of letting go, you know, of suffering is caused by clinging? It's just a question I have, because I just kind of see that what I love about the teachings in Buddhism is that we're offered all this wisdom, and then we are not dictated to and what to do with it, but to see how we are in relationship with it. So right. I understand that part of it in one way, and yet it's so important to kind of understand these, the, you know, these basic truths. So
that's just right.
About,
well, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that that's what's inferred you know, that, yeah, that if you want to be free from suffering, you have to let go. But it's not explicitly stated in this sutta, because it's interesting. I mean, I'm going back looking at it, and
because you could, you know, go to the other surmising, then don't fall in love, like you had kind of mentioned.
Right.
You could go either direction, right? I guess that leads us to the middle way.
That's exactly how I think of it, Deb. You know, exactly the middle way with it, because the idea that, oh, just don't have any relationships, like, no, human beings are social beings. And as I say, you go to a monastery and the people become connected with each other. It's not that they don't have any feelings about each other. Of course they do. In fact, the main reason that people leave the robes is that they fall in love with, you know, a monk or a nun, and they go off. That's, you know, there's lots of stories of that. So, but that's, you know, we shouldn't use that as an example, but, you know, I think, you know, even, you know, I talk about in Living Kindness, I talk about how when the Buddha is dying very towards the end of his life, his senior disciples, the ones who have been with him the longest, they have died. And he says, it feels as if the Sangha is empty. Well, when I hear that, I think, well, he misses them. You know, he's not that, he's not, you know, losing his mind, right? He hasn't lost his senses, but he feels something. It's not like this idea that somehow the Buddha doesn't have emotions, or we shouldn't have emotions, we shouldn't have normal human emotions. I think that's a very, like, deluded kind of way of thinking about spirituality. And, you know, and it's kind of typical of human beings in a way, that we look for some kind of extreme and like idea. Oh, the perfect being, like, doesn't have any, like, what? What do you mean? Like, they don't care about people? How is that a perfect being? Like, no, it makes much more sense that we feel, and we feel fully, but we're not overwhelmed. We're not, and we don't lose our minds. You know, we don't kill ourselves or get lost and be despairing. You know, there's, you know, a period of intense pain, and then, you know, we heal and move on.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me.
Yeah,
I find myself defending the dryness, quote unquote, as you say, that people kind of see in Buddhism, and go, no, it's not that way.
Yeah,
but it is interesting. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I think that as well, the people who kind of preserve the texts and the tradition sort of turned the Buddha into this idea, this idealized being who, you know, could not, nothing bothers him, or, you know, and I don't really believe that, you know, I don't think that's true. I mean, and you get hints. I mean, look at the fact that, you know, he brings his son into the Sangha at a very young age. And there are a couple of really important suttas that are addressed to his son. Like, you think he didn't care about his son? Of course he did, you know. And in fact, I think Rahula actually died at a fairly young age. I think he might have died before the Buddha. We never get to see how the Buddha felt about that. As far as I know, it's Julie, do you want to chime in?
Hi, I agree. I think that, you know, just acknowledging that there is a lot of suffering in life has given me freedom. Like, oh, this is the way, you know, things happen sometimes. And that you talk about the clinging. A lot of my suffering has been caused from clinging to the idea that I want things to go a certain way. And I, for example, with my 19-year-old and my 21-year-old sons, and right. I look back at the decisions my brothers made, you know, as young men, and I just have to let them go, you know, let them be and have the dignity of their own journey. And I've had a hard time, been sober 3.5 years, and there was a lot of losses, especially in my marriage. And I kind of cling to that a little bit too much. I think there's a lot of grief, but I think the more I accept the disease and how it impacts, you know, it's, I never envisioned myself to be a drug recovering drug addict alcoholic. I mean, not a drug addict alcoholic, but it's actually been a blessing in many ways.
Right.
And if I look at it that way, I don't know. It's just, I don't want it to be my story, you know,
right.
suffering and to be focused there. I want to focus more on, you know, moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it still creeps up. And I get into clinging to that. I was hanging out with some old friends and they're still married. And it was like, I just, it was hard for me. And it is what it is. And eventually I'm hoping I can shake that. You know, I think I've done a pretty good job as far as some situations, but yeah, it's just still an adjustment.
Well, again, I think, you know, if you got divorced and didn't feel bad, like what, in what world does that happen? You know, it's like, you know, maybe, you know, for some people, the great, you know, we had an amicable divorce and we're best friends. Okay, great. Good for you. But I mean, it seems very natural to me to grieve that and to go through a period of time where it's painful and, you know, and to be getting sober at the same time and to have a couple of, you know, young men that you're like looking out for as they're trying to navigate stuff. It's like, it's a lot. And that's perfectly natural. And I get, again, I think what I'm getting at, and it's kind of the two arrows teaching that we come back to so often. It's like, there are these difficult things. If I tell myself that it shouldn't be difficult, or I shouldn't feel this, or, you know, why is this happening to me? What's wrong with me that this is happening? Then I just compound it. And if I step back and look realistically, I see, well, of course there's difficulty here. Of course there's a certain amount of pain. It's not controlling my life. It's not dominating my life. It's just an aspect of it, and that I have to work with. And so I appreciate, you know, that whatever the challenges are, but I don't think we need to judge ourselves over having difficulties in lives. I mean, that, you know, that's why we're all here, is because we had problems. You know, we didn't come here because, you know, we didn't get into recovery. Because everything was so great in our lives. And so navigating that is always going to have a certain amount of challenge to it. Well, thank you all for coming. It's past 8:00. And so I'll just, let me see if I can come up with something good to wrap up with. Well, have a nice weekend. How about that? It's sunny in the Bay Area, which is very unusual. And I do feel like I've been like a bit of a downer the last, particularly tonight. So I just want to really encourage you to find some joy as well. So, yeah. Thank you.